Hi, I'm Raoul Pal, co-founder and CEO of Real Vision. Thank you so much for listening to the Real Vision podcast. At Real Vision, we pride ourselves in providing the best in-depth expert analysis available to help you understand the complex world of finance, business, and the global economy. If you like what you hear, I hope you'll accept my invitation to try Real Vision Plus for 30 days for just $1. Visit realvisionpodcast.com today and join us as we navigate the financial world together. Cheers.
Throughout 2017, whenever the topic of China came up, the answer was always the same. We'll know more after the 19th National Party Congress at the end of the year. For 10 months, investors assumed that stability would reign in the Middle Kingdom and that Xi Jinping would consolidate his power in late October in Beijing. On October 18th, after a 205-minute speech to open proceedings, Xi joined Mao Zedong as the only living party leader to have enshrined an ideology into the party's constitution named after himself. Stability had been maintained and power consolidated. But what now? How will Xi use this position as the most powerful leader of the Communist Party in a generation? And what does it mean for the rest of the world? This week, on Adventures in Finance, China. Today is the 25th of January 2018, and welcome to episode 51 of Adventures in Finance. Coming to you from all over the world this week, I am sat in Dubai. And a long way to my left is James in the Cayman Islands. Producer James, how are you, mate?
Not too bad. I think everyone's suffering from storms. He's suffering from sandstorms over there.
No, I'm suffering from perfect weather. Low 70s, no humidity, Crimea River. It's weather is beautiful here. Also to my left is Alex in New York this time, I believe.
Yes, it's a beautiful 45 degrees here, which is a big reprieve. So,
yes, it's so nice to be doing this from somewhere where the weather is perfect. It makes a real change. Now, this week we have a lot to get into. We're going to talk about China. As we head into 2018 with the 19th Party Congress firmly in our rearview mirror, we thought it was a great time to take a look at what might be in store for China, find out how things may be changing now that that once every 5 year event is out of the way. And to help us, we have two fantastic guests, Tian Yang from Variant Perception and my old friend Louis Garve from GavCal in Hong Kong. And we'll get to that shortly. But before we do, it's time for our long short segment. And Alex, I am going to let you go first this week, seeing as I stole the honor last week, I think.
Okay, very good. So I am long stock indexes. Or indices, indexes. Which name do you prefer?
You know, I'm agnostic. You can use either, or I will let you get away with either.
Okay, very good. So I am long both indexes and indices. There is a story in the Financial Times that there are now, this is almost too weird to believe, but 3.28 million indices, according to the Index Industry Association.
Holy cow. So I knew it was bad. I had no idea it was that bad.
Yeah, so most of them cover stock markets. Not all of them do. Very interesting, though, because the whole point of an index is it's not made for investment purposes necessarily. It's made to track how stocks are doing, and then if people want to invest in it and get the return of the stock market, they can do so. But if you have to choose among 3-point-something million to get the return of the stock market, it kind of takes a little of the purposeful lack of complexity out of it.
Well, we have ourselves a self-perpetuating circle here. If the stocks are supposed to track the indices and the indices outnumber the stocks, I'm not quite sure where that leaves us. Maybe there's some statisticians out there that can probably write in and explain to me. But I knew there was, in the US, I think last year, we crossed the line where there were more indices than stocks, which... Mm-hmm. was baffling to me at the time, but 3.2 million indices, that is lunacy. Although I'm not sure if going long them now is your best trade. I mean, maybe you should have been long them for the last few years. There seems to have been some sort of explosion in indices then.
It could be a bubble in indices themselves.
Well, it's not possible. It's possible. Well, seeing as you've led off with your long, I am going to lead off with my long. And I am long a 51-year-old ex-soccer player, George Weah, okay. who was sworn in this week as the new president of Liberia. Now, George Weah was a phenomenal football player. He won the Ballon d'Or, the World Player of the Year, back in the late 80s, maybe the 90s. I'm racking my brains to try and remember. But this is a fantastic story. You know, he was a hero to the country of Liberia. And his election and his swearing in this week marks the first peaceful democratic transition of power in almost 50 years in that country. You know, it's a very poor country. Mm. He's an inspirational figure. And so hopefully things will be looking up for little Liberia out there on the African coast. So I am long George Weah, God bless him, a great footballer, and now hopefully a great head of state for Liberia.
Now, do they have a serious soccer team, or as you would call it, a football team in Liberia?
Well, what do you mean, as I would call it, a football team? It's called a football team. Don't be throwing that at me. You call your game football, we call our game football. Only one of them is one where a ball is kicked with a foot. We'll leave it at that, shall we? I mean, George Weah is by far the most famous and by far the most talented footballer ever to come out of Liberia. I mean, he really was a world star. And I don't think they've seen his like since. And who knows how many years it will be until they see another player with his talent. But, it's a great story. He's a hero to kids. It's engaged the youth in that country. And, they've been through a 15-year civil war. It's about time Liberia had some good news to celebrate. So George Weah is absolutely my long this week.
Very good.
Well, that leaves us shorts. Why don't I kick this one off, seeing as I let you go first with the longs? I hate to do it because I know I'm poking that badger with the spoon again, but this week I'm short ICOs.
Oh, my
there
God.
Was a there was an Ernst & Young report that came out, I think yesterday, certainly earlier this week, that said that more than 10% of the funds raised through initial coin offerings are lost or stolen by hackers. Now, that's an extraordinary amount of money, particularly when you realize it was just shy of $4 billion that was raised last year. So that's almost $400 million stolen by hackers out of ICOs. I mean, it's just amazing. This is mostly through phishing. So you've got to think that there is a sign here that perhaps the people getting involved in Bitcoin aren't as technically savvy as they ought to be on the basis that they get fooled by phishing scams. I mean, hackers were stealing about $1.5 million a month in ICO proceeds. Nobody is praising the Bitcoin phenomenon more than the hackers, it would seem, who, between them, they don't have to launder money through the dark web or through cryptocurrency anymore. They can just steal it straight from the source. It really is cutting out the middleman.
Yeah, it's a shame that the money's lost or stolen by hackers when you would hope it'd be lost or stolen by the people leading the ICOs, which is another place the money goes.
Well, yeah, no, exactly right. I mean, this is one of my big fears over all cryptocurrencies, that the people trying to steal it know a lot more about the technology than most of the people trying to hang on to it, and I think that's a recipe for disaster. So this Ernst & Young report just confirmed that. But once again, this is a public service announcement for all Bitcoin maniacs out there. I do not, repeat, not think Bitcoin is a complete fraud or is going to go to zero. I still think the technology is remarkable and game-changing. So please, 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 if you have any criticism of my thoughts on Bitcoin, feel free to send me an email to james@realvision.com. That's james@realvision.com. And feel free to use the strongest language possible.
Should you actually be giving my Real Vision address out to the world?
So you know what? Should we risk it and see how many emails you get?
I say let's risk it.
I'll go short at double figures. boy. Okay. Right. Back to the action. So, Alex, having poked the badger with a spoon and manfully stood up and given people a right to reply. That's james@realvision.com. Time for your short, my friend. What are you short this week?
Yeah, I am short lifeguard buffness.
You're short? Wait, what? Who, what?
Lifeguard buffness. The buffness of lifeguards.
Oh, yes. Okay. Now you explain it that way, it makes more sense.
Uh-huh. So there's a story out of Australia that they were flying this lifeguard drone, which has a very Australian name, the Little Ripper, which it sounds great with an Australian accent, I bet. But they were flying it in this beach just as a practice, and they actually saw two men swimming in powerful surf and potentially set to get overpowered by the waves. And it would have taken a long time, and it would risk the lifeguard's life if they had actually swam out. So even though it was just a practice mission, they threw down from the drone a rescue pod. The swimmers grabbed the pod, and they made their way to shore, and they were completely fine. So it's a really great story. But the guy who was running the pod is a lifeguard himself. His name is Jai Sheridan. And while he is buff, it seems future lifeguards might just need good drone skills, and they won't need those kind of Baywatch bodies anymore. So lifeguard buffness is a major short.
This is fantastic for normal-shaped men everywhere.
Yeah, although I thought the whole point was you got to, you know, sit out there on the beach and flick that whistle around. It's not quite as sexy if you're down there looking at your tablet.
Well, I mean, if the weather's bad or it's too hot, you can stay home and fly the drone. I mean, this is great news.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not sure. I dare say the female listeners to the podcast will be cancelling holidays to Australia left and right. But all right, well, that's. I like this one. I'm going to go short with you along with this. This is
all right.
This is fantastic news.
Come on board.
All right, well, look, let's move on to our feature this week, which revolves around China. And hopefully, as we go into a new year, it's a good time to get some perspective on any changes that might be happening in China, because it does feel like we're at an inflection point with the 19th Congress out the way, Xi Jinping cementing his position as the country's leader. And along with that cementing a position comes a certain freedom to perhaps change the way they do things. So we have two fantastic guests joining us to give us their insight onto what might be happening. Shortly, we'll be talking to my dear friend Louis Gav of GavCal in Hong Kong. But first, it's time to welcome Tian Yang of Variant Perception to the show. Tian's joining us from Beijing. Tian, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you with us. I want to jump in straight away with a question about the kind of the closing of the 19th Congress, because we went into that basically the whole of last year with people saying that we had to keep stability, everything had to be managed until we got through that Congress. Obviously, it finished in November, it's behind us now, we have a new year starting. So I wanted to get a sense of exactly what it was that we had to kind of keep stable. And now that event is in our rearview mirror, what do you think that does in terms of freeing up Xi Jinping to change his agenda or strengthen some of the moves he makes to control the economy?
So really, where you want to start in China is to actually look at where leading indicators are going and then use that to put kind of the political discussion in the correct context. So what we're seeing right now with Chinese growth is that leading indicators have rolled over somewhat. So it suggests that growth is going to slow, but there's not necessarily anything too scary kind of on the horizon. So, you know, the likes of real money growth has slowed a little bit. If you look at, say, the PMI surveys, in particular, the supply delivery times component, you can see that supply delivery times have shortened, indicating that there's a bit more slack within the industrial supply chain. So there's a few signs showing that growth is going to slow a little bit from last year. But the growth is actually coming against a backdrop of still quite tight liquidity conditions. So one of the big moves in 2017 was that Chinese 10-year yields actually rallied quite a lot and hit 4%. At the same time, the PBOC was obviously cracking down on, you know, wealth management products, on shadow finance. And so we saw that for a lot of the non-bank financial institutions, their rate of balance sheet growth slowed quite dramatically. So what you actually have in China is growth slowing a bit, still quite high liquidity conditions. But at the same time, the Fed has also obviously been, you know, there's a few hikes pricing. It's going to potentially tighten policy this year. So it's very likely the PBOC is actually going to shadow the Fed policy and continue to tighten, even though liquidity is already quite tight and growth is rolling over. So what we do see in China is that, you know, even independent of the political events, growth will actually start to disappoint this year. And then obviously on top of that, if you have, you know, a lot of the stated reforms around changing the composition of growth, right? Obviously higher quality, you know, focusing on tech, focusing on consumer, you know, there's definitely going to be some China slowing. There's obviously this five-year seasonality pattern where typically after every five-year plenum, you know, there's an attempt to push reform and growth does slow a little bit. So I think that's kind of in line. I would say this is probably not too controversial in terms of consensus market opinion right now. But I do think there are certain parts of the market where this isn't actually being quite fully priced in. And so in particular, related to this, one particular kind of investment theme we like this year is actually to sell the Korean won. And in particular, we actually like going long the Chinese RMB against Korean won. So long CNH, short KRW. This is actually quite attractive because right now what's happened is that Korea is ultimately still heavily dependent on China. You know, 25% of all Korean exports actually do go to China. And if you look at their business cycles, it's, you know, highly synchronized. What we've had in 2017 is that obviously you've had this wave where China is doing well. You know, there was this global synchronized upswing. Korea obviously had very, very good export performance, but a lot of this is starting to roll over. So in addition to kind of the China slowing, also in Korea domestically, a lot of the leading indicators are rolling over as well. So yield curves are flattening, you know, indicators of kind of inventory circulars within the export sector is also slow quite dramatically. But the Korean won has actually rallied a lot, and the Bank of Korea actually hiked rates. So you've actually created this situation where the won has rallied relative to the RMB to kind of a major support level. So if you actually look at the chart, it's kind of quite a significant kind of five-year support level around the 160, 165 range where we've kind of been trading, and we're actually starting to bounce from there. So, you know, I think this is a very attractive theme to keep our eye on, actually position for this year on the back of China. In terms of China itself, I would say because there is this kind of, you know, probably overly, you know, investors probably a bit too overly focused on policy that, you know, everyone is aware there's going to be a slowing. So I think domestic China plays might not actually be as interesting as kind of looking for, you know, the pockets of the global macro space where this China slowdown isn't as discounted. And there certainly we think Korea is quite a big outlier at the moment.
So I'm curious if politics is overemphasized in China, is this just another sign that China's becoming more like other global economies that are, you know, if you're talking about the U.S. economy, you're probably going to look at where corporate earnings are, where perhaps sentiment is, where we are in the economic cycle, and not who just took power, although that's maybe in the, somewhere in the top five. Is China becoming maybe more mixed in what contributes to its economic growth? And as another question, what are people underemphasizing if they're overemphasizing political policy?
Actually, that's a great question. So I think I will characterize it as the main issue with political catalysts is that the lead lag relationships are highly variable. So if you can't really use it, in our opinion, to form kind of the core of your thesis, you need to kind of have it as if it happens, it potentially works in your favor. So, you know, I don't think it's wrong to actually realize that there is kind of these various political kind of events, right, that can potentially influence policy. You know, in particular, you know, we do know China's obviously the government's a lot more heavily involved, right, especially if they push infrastructure investment. We know obviously central bank independence kind of a lot less in China, right? The PBOC and the government are going to work a lot more in sync in terms of directing policy. So certainly you can't ignore it, but I think it's being positioned the same kind of, you know, if you align with the indicators, you'll kind of be positioned the same way, right? So, you know, at the beginning of 2016, that was a time when we were actually very, very bullish on China, when I would say most of the consensus was very bearish. You know, there was a lot of calls that, you know, the RMB was going to collapse, you know, Chinese growth was going to collapse. But what you saw at the time was that leading indicators were already turning up, and that with the indicators turning up, then when the government starts talking about easing policy, talk about supporting growth, that's when they're going to be able to actually see the impact straight away and change the market narrative, right? So, you know, even though the turn kind of happened at the beginning of 16, the PBOC had actually been easing policy for most of 2015. So, you know, if you just watch kind of the central bank or just watch government or just watch kind of the noise or the press releases, then what you would have, the opinion would have been that, okay, they've started easing towards the beginning of 15 and you'd have probably reacted a bit too early. But so instead, if you kind of just watch for when these things happen and then wait for leading indicators to turn up, that's probably where the most powerful combination is. And in that sense, I think this actually applies to kind of all the kind of major economies, right? Even like the US, when we actually think about say monetary policy, for example, clearly, obviously, you know, rates, you know, where policy rates are set is very important, but it's not the only determinant of actual liquidity conditions and what's actually going to ultimately drive asset prices. What you really care about is its impact on the private sector as well. So, you know, something we focus very heavily here at Varian Perception is this concept of excess liquidity, which is essentially looking at kind of narrow money growth minus economic growth, right? So it's this proxy for how much liquidity is being created in the system overall that's not being used by the real economy, and which therefore tends to be excess and tends to flow into asset prices and offer that support. And so here, the reason we look at, say, narrow money growth is because it doesn't just capture central bank actions, right? It has to also capture commercial bank actions. So, you know, this, you know, the U.S. obviously a very good example right now, right? So people are saying, okay, quantitative tightening, you know, rates are going up, liquidity conditions are tightening. Well, that doesn't necessarily have to be a one-for-one, right? Because if, say, suddenly, you know, animal spirits pick up, commercial banks want to start lending, they start lowering lending standards, demand for loans picks up, then there could actually be quite a lot of, you know, thin air money creation from the commercial banking system that can even potentially offset the kind of the start of quantitative tightening from the Fed. So, you know, within our framework in terms of thinking about policy drivers, you know, it's clearly something we need to be aware of. But really, the key really is to be kind of aligned with where leading indicators are going. The analogy is kind of like, you know, you want to sail where you want to figure out the direction of the wind and then sail that way, and I hope that a lot of these kind of catalysts come through.
Just to zoom out a little bit, and you touched on the old economy versus the new economy, if you had to give a grade maybe on how effective China has been at making the transition from an industrial and you know, maybe agrarian commodity-based economy to a consumer-driven and technology-driven economy, obviously a long project, but where are they in that, and how would you grade their progress?
I think progress has actually been very, very good. You know, historically, this is kind of what economists talk about, right? The middle income trap, where historically it's been very, very difficult for, you know, emerging market, emerging economies to kind of reach, do that initial catch-up growth and then really kind of power on from there. You know, the only kind of successful stories have been, you know, like the Taiwan, South Korea, you know, maybe Japan. But obviously, in terms of population and size, these have been relatively small economies compared to China. But I think, you know, given the size of China, I think, and you know, the kind of infrastructure you need to actually build up, I think they've been able to kind of do things in parallel, where, you know, China's overnight become leader in a lot of kind of, you know, fintech areas, right? Say global payments. You know, that's something where there's a lot more, you know, mobile payments, you know, microtransactions in China, right, with the consumer, where the ecosystem is actually a lot more developed than in the West. And indeed, there's, you know, certain technologies that are actually being developed in China first that's going abroad, right? So, you know, Dockless bike sharing, you know, being one of the most famous ones recently, where, you know, the concept kind of really took off in China, then they're now trying to go global with it. So I think the balance has actually been quite good, where because you've had this huge internal market, it's been China has been able to kind of experiment with a lot of these things within its own backyard, and then kind of trying to figure things out and transition, and hasn't really necessarily had to deal with what a lot of probably medium-sized economies have had to do historically, which is, you know, they're overly dependent on global demand, overly dependent on the kind of developed economies, so that as those cycles turn, what they do domestically matters a bit less. I mean, China's actually striking a reasonable line down the middle. So overall, I think, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of transition, they're doing all the right things. The problem really isn't that, you know, the transition's wrong or that they can't. The problem is still that in the catch-up phase, when you grow by using so much debt, you have to recognize the actual kind of built-up losses within the system. So that's really the problem, right? So it's more how you kind of recognize those losses and how you deal with those losses rather than necessarily the transition. I think the transition is going pretty well. The key is more, will there be enough kind of a pickup in growth that allows all the previous kind of built-up losses or the kind of low-return investments where to be effectively amortized over time, right? Where, you know, your consumer and your tech sector pick up enough to allow you to kind of inflate away effectively the kind of losses from the old economy and industrial sectors. I think that's the challenge. And, you know, and if you understand that, then you can kind of really understand the context of a lot of the global policies China is pushing, right? So obviously, let's talk about One Belt, One Road. Obviously, you know, in 16, 17, Chinese companies have been on this acquisition kind of rampage, right, through the global markets, where a lot of it is about trying to take the existing wealth and resources generated from, the say, the old economy or commodity-based industry manufacturing, and trying to acquire technologies, acquire you know, new concepts, right, related to, say, Industry 4.0 and so forth, to try and really transform the economy and to try and generate that productivity growth. So I think they are trying to do all the right things. And really, that's really what you can do. But, you know, the fundamental question is more, if you have a lot of these, you know, if you have too much debt and there are losses going in the system, what do you do with it? And that's still something that hasn't been resolved. And that's really kind of, I guess, the bare thesis around China in terms of where the focus is.
Great question. I'll turn it back to you on that one. And just to add in the mix, I mean, there has been a popular bear case on China, obviously, for many years, that becomes almost apocalyptic in nature, referring not to just China, but all of the global growth picture, since it's so reliant on China. I guess, where are they, obviously, in terms of the debt, but also what do you make of that kind of scary bear case that we've all heard about? China's debt is unsustainable, and they're going to have to go through some major shakeup that's going to threaten growth in every country in the world.
So I'm sympathetic to the logic, because obviously if you follow the train of logic through it, it does make sense. I think that the issue is more the assumptions that you make at the start and whether those are valid, right? So I think there's a few cases. There's some special case about China, right? One is obviously a lot of debt is denominated in local currency and not foreign currency. So this is a very, very important difference compared to a lot of historical kind of credit crises, right? So the closest analogy probably being like Japan, where, you know, they're still running obviously absurdly high levels of debt to GDP, but you haven't had this kind of crisis, right? You know, shorting JGB has obviously been the widowmaker trade for kind of, you know, since the 2000s, kind of, you know, a lot of macro funds trying to do that. And I think China is kind of following that similar path. Well, on the one hand, because you have a lot of debt that's domestic currency, it's quite hard for the market to force your hand to kind of recognize losses immediately. And the second thing really is cultural, in terms of political preference for addressing the debt problem, right? Because once it's local, then it's your choice and what you want to do with it. Obviously, for kind of more free market oriented philosophies, right? So, you know, the likes of, you know, in America, you know, in Europe, then there's a lot of times where there's a recognition that there's good bankruptcy law. It makes sense to recognize losses so that you can clean up balance sheets and move on. But I think this kind of mentality isn't quite as prevalent in Asia. And, you know, if you look at China and Japan, where there's more emphasis on kind of status quo continuity. So, you know, there's like a saying in Chinese, you know, where you'd say you try and cross the river by feeding out the stones, right? So if you take a step at a time, right? You know, dip your foot and you feel where the next stone is, you know, if it's stable and you walk. So that there's this general mentality to move slowly, increments, and then shift, and not this kind of recognize all the losses at once, you know, clean it up, move on kind of mentality. So I think those are the kind of two things where it makes a lot more sense in kind of Western free market-based economies. That isn't quite true in China's case. So it allows kind of the sequence of events to probably play out where it will be a lot closer to Japan, where it's, you know, a long, drawn-out process. You know, Japan's still not over, right? And I think that's probably going to be a lot closer to the China case than any kind of this apocalypse type event. Oh, and very importantly, actually, the third key point here is obviously the capital account, where, again, if you look at the capital flow data, you know, China FX reserves inflows, their clampdown on capital outflows and indeed leakages have been obviously very, very successful, right? So if you're able to get control of your capital account, then you don't necessarily have to have this currency crisis. Because, you know, if you think back to the kind of impossible trinity of essentially independent monetary policy, free capital flows, and free floating exchange rates, you can't have all three. But in China's case, what they've done is try to give up free flow of capital, right? They're controlling it a lot more closely. And so by doing that, they've actually, and you can see in the data, so because they're able to get hold of the capital account, then you're able to kind of run monetary policy and keep a reasonably stable exchange rate. I think generally speaking, you want to, strategically, obviously, you want to allocate where there's a big internal market, right, and where people are underinvested. I think China certainly fits. But in the short term, there's clearly going to be bumps in the road. But kind of as I said a bit earlier, I think where the opportunity is in terms of expressing the short China story is not necessarily in something directly related to China, right? Where, you know, if you look at the likes of Korea, those are probably going to be areas that are going to react a lot more. You know, even if you are bearish on China, you believe in the apocalypse case, you know, the things that ultimately move the most and help you make the most money is not the most obvious one, right? If everybody in the world recognizes that it's going to be a kind of, you know, RMB devaluation event, that everyone's positioned for it, it's probably not going to be the thing that reacts the most. So I think it's more a case of looking for things that are correlated that to China but that are directly influenced. And I think Korea definitely stands out as where there's kind of one of the biggest divergences between where we see China going and what the market is pricing.
Okay, very good. Tian Yang of Variant Perception, thanks so much for your time. Where can people find more of your work?
So, you know, I think we're mainly an institutional service. So for institutional, professional investors, then obviously we are an independent research provider. So we operate basically a subscription model. If you're interested, you can look at our website, variantperception.com. Obviously, for more casual users, you know, we do obviously also maintain a blog, and we try and keep in contact with kind of the general finance community as well by appearing, you know, podcasts like yourselves here as well. So that's probably the main kind of avenues.
Tian, thanks so much for your time today.
Cool. Thanks very much. Cheers.
So I thought it was interesting. He made that point that politics, looking at politics, is not a very good way to see where China's going, at least in the short term, since the outcomes can be so variable. And also since politics is taking a little bit of a backseat to what's actually going on in the Chinese economy in a way that makes it more reminiscent of other countries.
Yeah, there's clearly a shift. I think you kind of get a sense when these things happen. And it does seem to me as though some of the numbers coming out suggest that there has been a shift. And one man I know who will have a lot of information on whether that shift is taking place, and if so, what it means, is a very good friend of mine from GavCal in Hong Kong, Louis Garvalo. He's not in Hong Kong. He's up in the snow-capped mountains of Canada. So, Louis, welcome to Adventures in Finance.
Thank you very much, Grant. Always good to catch up.
So you are currently in Canada, enjoying the snow instead of in China, in Hong Kong, enjoying the nice weather. Bunch of stuff going on.
200 pollution reading today in Hong Kong. So it's nice to not be there this week.
Yeah, right. Good time to be in peaceful Canada. So as we head into a new year, we just thought it was a great chance to take stock of what's happening in China and get a sense from someone on the ground, and you were the first name that jumped to mind. So I wanted to just get a general sense from you overall before we get into some specifics, and just now that the Congress is out the way, get your sense of how things stand as the setup for 2018, if you like.
Well, I think we've just had a very, very important policy shift in China. You and I have spoken several times over the years, and, you know, I've always tended to have a fairly constructive view about China. I've always tended to, be fairly, fairly positive about the place. And the reason I was mostly positive about the place was I always looked at it through Charlie Munger's prism of saying, look, show me the incentives and I'll tell you the outcome. That's what Charlie Munger always says. And in China, the incentive was always to deliver as much growth as possible. Specifically, whether you were the mayor of Wuhan, the party secretary of Anhui province, the governor of Shandong, you were told when you were sent out into the boonies, you were told, hey, if you want to make it back to Beijing one day and get a bigger job, go out there and show us what you can do, deliver strong growth. And so you could almost always bet your bottom dollar that China would always hit certain growth targets, that you would always have, property investments approved, new factories approved, basically everything being rubber stamped, and that growth in China would continue growing strongly. The big change that we saw with the 19th Party Congress was basically Xi Jinping stood in front of the 3,600 party members this fall and told them, guys, you're no longer going to be measured just on growth. Growth is still important, of course, but from now on, so is pollution. So is social housing. So is education. And we're going to measure you on a whole bunch of different things. And I think this really changes the parameters through which we should look at China. Because for years, what you could kind of always count on is, A, China would always deliver a certain amount of growth for the world, and B, because of that, China could be counted on to always add over capacity into our system. We've had 20 years of deflation, which did correspond to 20 years of China's rise. And why? Because China was always adding over capacity into the system. I think the question investors should ask themselves today is this going to be the case for the next 5-10 years? Very clearly, things are already changing. Imagine for a second, Graham, that you're the mayor of Wuhan, and you're sitting in that hall, and Xi Jinping is now telling you, from now on, I'm going to look at you and how you do for your town on pollution. I'm going to look at you and how you do on social housing and so forth. What do you do when you come back to Wuhan? Well, I think the first thing you do is you say, all right, boys, no more coal. From now on, we're using just natural gas. And so you see the price of natural gas double in a couple months in China. So just right off the bat, boom. You start to see shortages of natural gas, which creates distortion and production issues all over the place. So I guess the point I'm making is a very simple one. From now on, I think we should expect more growth disappointments from China, number one. And number two, we should expect more inflationary pressures from China. If you look at, and it's already happening, if you look at things like steel, like cement, it's very interesting because prices are shooting up in China and production is actually going down. Now, this is fairly new. In the past, whenever prices go up in China, you can bet your bottom dollar that production would go up. That basically higher prices triggers a supply response fairly quickly. This is not happening. In fact, what we're seeing is the other way around. Production being curtailed and thus prices going up.
Maybe just say more about that. Like, do you think this is going to be a shift in the Chinese economy over the next 5 years that ultimately will lead to greater and more economically sustainable growth over the next, decades to come? Or, and maybe the growth will lag in the short term, or are we sort of maybe seeing the end of China's greatest growth years?
I think we've definitely seen the end of China's greatest growth years. The double-digit nominal growth that we had for basically 2 decades are now behind us. We are heading towards lower growth rates, and I think you see it on a number of fronts. Not only, of course, the change in government policy as regards to pollution, as regards to adding overcapacity willy-nilly, but also in its policies regarding leverage. For years, China didn't seem to care of the increase in leverage that you saw throughout the economy. And frankly, I argued many times, it didn't really need to care for that increase in leverage because it was starting from such a low base that it could afford that increase in leverage, especially when you looked at the simultaneous rise in domestic savings. The reality, of course, now is that China's demographically is starting to tip over, like a lot of Western countries. As you age, you save less. And with that comes also a shift in China's relationship to leverage. And so today you are seeing shifts in government policy when it comes to, adding capacity, adding growth, regardless of the cost. And you're seeing a very important shift when it comes to leverage. And there is a very clear government policy desire to maybe not reduce leverage, but definitely not see it increase from here. So, you look at this from many different angles, and yes, growth in China is going to be less strong. And for all of us sitting in the Western world, the question is this inflationary or deflationary for the rest of us? Now, you might argue, well, it's deflationary because, less growth from China must equal deflation. I'm not so sure. I think it could very well be inflationary because it means less overcapacity, less ability for us to basically undercut Western workers constantly by transferring production over to China, where production is probably being produced at the wrong price.
Yeah, that segues perfectly to my next question, Louis, which is this idea that we are seeing a structural shift in China where it's moving towards lower growth and perhaps exporting inflation instead of deflation. Do you think this is more of a problem, perhaps, this transition for China or for the West? Because it seems to me like it may be a bigger problem for the West than it actually is for China.
You know me, Grant, I always like to answer a question with another question.
So, what is
the most interesting development of the past, say, 6 months? For me, it's the simultaneous rise in U.S. bond yields and fall in the U.S. dollar, and frankly, fall in the U.S. dollar against every currency out there. The U.S. dollar has been very, very weak, while U.S. bond yields have been going up. Now, you know, you've spent your fair share of time in Asia and in other emerging markets. That's a typical emerging market thing to do, right? Having rising yield and falling currency simultaneously is what you start to see in emerging markets when they start basically having leaned too far above their skis, having, you know, spent too much money, having had budget deficits run out of control. That's what you start to see that happen, rising yield and falling currency. That's what you're seeing in the U.S. today. So to answer your question, is that a problem for the U.S. or is that a problem or the Western world in general, or is that a problem for Asia or China? I think it's more a problem for the Western world. Why? You may remember this because, you know, we've known each other a long time. Back in 2005, I wrote a book called Our Brave New World. The thesis of that book was pretty simple. The thesis of the book was, look, companies do three things. They design the good, manufacture the good, sell the good. The smart companies today are shifting and this was written back in 2005, they pass on the manufacturing to whoever wants to do it in China. They focus on design, they focus on sales. And in the book, I use Apple as an example, I use IKEA, I use Enz & Mortz, and I call these guys platform companies. Now, when you think of it, this is how almost every Western company has organized itself for the past 15 years. And it's been a very successful business model. The question is, are we coming to the limit of that business model? Let me put it even another way. The current bull market that we're in essence, when you read the press, when you listen to the media, rests on two pillars. The first pillar is thanks to big data, thanks to artificial intelligence, thanks to globalization, companies today are very diligent with capital, and we have the highest return on invested capital we've ever had. Everything is optimized to the very top so that, yes, we should pay more for equities because companies are smarter with capital. And that's fine. So that's your first pillar. Your second pillar is, and we live in a world of massive overcapacity, and so there's massive deflation constantly, and thus central banks need to print money. Okay, that's fine. But how do you get from one to two? I mean, if companies are super smart with their data, and super efficient with their allocation of capital, how do we have all this excess capacity in the system? Well, the bottom line is that there must be some idiots in the system who always overinvest. And that idiot has been China. The question is, what if it isn't China anymore? What if China is saying, you know what, I'm done increasing leverage. I'm done adding capacity willy-nilly. I'm changing my business model. Then what does that leave for the rest of the world? Because if you look at the Western world, frankly, in the past 10, 15 years of very low interest rates, where have we added capacity? You know, you think of it, when was the last time a factory was built in the West, a new power plant? So we've spent 10 or 15 years basically piggybacking off the overinvestments done in China. What if this is now done? Then the inflation risk could be much greater than people anticipate.
What does that mean, I guess, in the medium and long term for commodity prices if we're seeing this shift out of China?
That's the very tricky point. For years, you could have argued that there was a sort, in our research 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we called it the Wen Jibao put, in a sort of response to the Greenspan puts on equities. We called it the Wenjibao put. Wenjibao was the previous premier in China. The Wenjibao put on commodities, that basically if growth fell enough, China would step in with new capacity, new investments to relaunch growth, thereby triggering a new demand for commodities. So you could argue for years we had the Wenjibao put on commodities, that China would come in with a bid once growth fell hard enough, just like you had the Greenspan put on equities. Of course, you could say, well, the Wenjibao put hasn't really worked that great for the past 5 years. And instead, what we saw was serious consolidation in the commodity world. What I find interesting today in the commodity space is that just as China is saying, basically, look, we're done leveraging up, we will accept lower growth, we do worry a lot about pollution. Basically, as China is going 180 degrees on a lot of the things they've done for the past, really, well, for most of our careers, or at least the past 15, 20 years, commodities continue to crank up. And I think that's a reflection of potentially what I was highlighting before, just the lack of investments that have been made in new production capacity. And that's not just in commodities, but in manufacturing and just a number of industries across the board. I mean, look at it this way. I was once told that when the VC industry raises $30 billion in a given year, that's usually the top of the VC cycle. That, you know, when all the VC funds together raise $30 billion, that's usually the top, and you know that stupid prices are going to be around the corner. Well, last year, SoftBank by itself announced a $100 billion fund. So we've had billions pour into private equity, billions pour in to the VC industry. But what investments have gotten out of all this money pouring in? In the past, you would have had things like Cisco and Xerox and Hewlett Packard and others. Today, out of all that money that pours into VC, what we have is Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, Snapchat, Dropbox, or whatever else. What we have fundamentally is investments either in social media. When you look at your top 20 unicorns in the world, they're either A, social media, or what we've come to call in our firm, overcapacity optimizers. You know, think Lyft, Uber, Airbnb. You've got a car, you're not using it, we can use it for you. You've got a room, you're not using it, we'll use it for you. But none of that adds capacity fundamentally to our system. Instead, what we've seen in the commodity space in recent years has been an extreme example of it, is a consolidation in capacity. You've seen a record amount of mergers and acquisitions, of private equity taking firms private, of consolidation, and this across a number of sectors. And so now all of a sudden, you know, you have China saying, look, we're done adding capacity. And I think that will lead a number of industries, not least of which commodities, which is what we're seeing today, to have genuine pricing power.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I agree with every word of that, Louis. It seems to be the way it's going to me. I just want to shift gears a little here because... Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. If I can just interrupt really quickly, Grant.
Yeah.
I think it's a very important... You use the word shift, and I agree. You know, our starting point when we allocate money is we say, all right, there's two forces that determine asset prices, inflation and growth. So you can have an inflationary boom or an inflationary bust, or a deflationary boom or a deflationary bust. Now, for the past 30 years, we've basically shifted from deflationary boom to deflationary bust every 7 to 10 years because growth goes on a 7 to 10 year cycle. But we've been pretty firmly planted in the bottom half of our four-quadrant diagram, basically moving from disinflationary boom to disinflationary bust and back and forth. If we move to the upper part of the diagram, towards the inflationary boom or inflationary bust, that's a shift that only occurs every 35 to 40 years. And thus, it's a shift that most money managers have never gone through before, myself included. You know, My dad obviously has been through it because he invested money in the inflationary boom and bust before it became deflationary boom and bust. But, you know, he's 75. Most people haven't gone through that shift from top to bottom. We've all gone through from left to right. We've never gone from top to bottom. And so it's a shift that, A, most people have never experienced before, and B, most people's portfolios are just not optimized for whatsoever because, you know, it hasn't happened in 40 years. So, you know, all the models, all the risk parity, all the CTA models, et cetera, could be at risk of seriously breaking down if such a shift were to occur.
Yeah, you make a great point, Louis. I mean, this idea that we're moving from a deflationary secular trend into an inflationary one, it seems, the evidence seems to be pointing heavily towards that. And I think you're right. I don't think anybody's really equipped for that. I mean, this 35-year bond bull market, if that has changed and we are going to go the other way, these things tend to move for a long, long time in the other direction. So I think it's definitely something we have to keep an eye on. But just jumping back to China and just getting into the micro a little bit, we had a story come out this week about Pudong Bank and some bad loan data. And getting into the micro data, you know, the numbers in this thing are extraordinary. The story, for anyone that hasn't heard it, is that the banking regulators uncovered some fake reporting from Shanghai Pudong Development Bank. They've basically been lending money to shell companies so they could hide bad loans at one of their big branches. But we're talking 1,500 shell companies and $12 billion. You know, it's an extraordinary story. And when I read it first, it just struck me that maybe after the Congress and with the shift by President Xi, it seems as though it might be time to flush out some of the bad actors. Does this strike you as something like that, or is this just a story that's found its time to be brought into the sunlight?
No, I think you're right. I think it's time for that. I think there's another dimension. If you look at Xi Jinping and his big anti-corruption drive, the big anti-corruption drive was mostly an attempt by Xi Jinping to clear out of the government the entire Jiang Zemin clique. Because if you remember, so, you know, Jiang Zemin was the president before Hu Jintao, who himself was president before Xi Jinping. And basically, Jiang Zemin kept his own guys in power, and his guys were known broadly as the Shanghai clique, because Jiang Zemin's power base was all around Shanghai. And those guys were indeed, there was a very hard, I mean, you could say, well, they're all corrupt, but I guess it's varying degrees. And the Shanghai clique did, you know, they did put a lot of money in their pockets. And they also prevented Hu Jintao from, you know, following the policy that he sometimes wanted to follow. And so when Xi Jinping came in, the first thing he tried to do, and the everything he's been doing since then, really, and that was a big drive of the anti-corruption drive, was to take these guys to town. Now, Shanghai Pudong Bank is obviously most likely one of the funding vehicles for some of the more nefarious activities of the Shanghai clique. So you could look at this as, you know, one part of the continued anti-corruption drive / Xi Jinping taking down the Shanghai clique. You could look at it as one of the signals that, look, we are serious about the deleveraging. We are serious about no more loans for just dubious projects. You can look at it as part of this message that, hey, it isn't all about growth anymore. We are going to start looking at how this growth has been generated. And if it's been generated through dubious loans, you will be taken down. Now, to your point, you know, $10, $12 billion is obviously not, I think it sends a strong message, no doubt. And, you know, a lot of people will end up in jail over this. But it's not strong enough to lead to a systemic risk for China. So, you know, I think if you turned around and wanted to look for dubious things at ICBC or at China Construction Bank, you could easily find some. But then you'd risk having a serious systemic issue. The good thing about Shanghai Pudong Bank is you send a strong message without creating without creating a systemic risk for the system.
Yeah, I think one of the things that struck me about the story is that obviously the accounting fraud that was part of it, where they reported no bad loans, and this was a way to that they were inflating their earnings and faking other data as well, according to this Bloomberg story. I guess maybe in closing, you know, this is a problem that crops up again and again with China. We talked about GDP data, and that obviously has its own issues of potential manipulation, and we know of some cases of manipulation in some parts of China. Taking the perspective of someone who's trying to look at Chinese data and look at Chinese numbers and either choose what to do in investing in China specifically or even in making macroeconomic calls based on Chinese data, you know, what would you say is a good way to go about it? Are there numbers we can trust? Is there a sense that we can trust the general flow of numbers instead of specific numbers? Just kind of curious how you would advise an investor to look at China from a portfolio perspective, keeping in mind the accounting and numbers issues.
That opens a real Pandora's box, and we could talk about this for hours. I'll just make a few key points. The first, when you look at China, you have to acknowledge that it's a little bit like an impressionist painting. You're never going to get a very clear picture, but if you get enough little points, you can kind of tell more or less what's happening. So you say, all right, there's a lake over here, and there's maybe people sitting over by that side of the lake, even if you can't quite tell if they're women or men. So it's, you never get like a full realist picture. Now you could say, well, it's the same with data everywhere, and that's true. The second point I make is the reality is, you know, Chinese data has gotten better and does continue to get better. You know, we have to acknowledge that, you know, 15 years ago, China did start to become very important for the world. So everybody was looking at their data, but fundamentally it was still an emerging market with a fairly poor statistical arm, and that has been improving all the time, partly because, of course, the Chinese Communist Party itself wants to know what's happening, which brings me to the third point. I think the Chinese data will continue to get much better in the next 5 years, partly because of this shift in incentives. If the government tells you, hey, you're being measured on growth, imagine you're the governor of Anhui province and you're being told you're being measured on growth. Oh, and by the way, you also get to tell us what the growth number is. Guess what? It's probably going to be better than what it really is, right? You have every incentive to push that number up as much as you credibly can stretch. And so you've had a lot of that happening. And by the way, as they've shifted the incentive structure, you've already had a number of provinces come out and said, oh, well, maybe last year our number wasn't quite so strong. You saw it in Inner Mongolia, you saw it in Shandong. And I think as you shift the incentive structure in China, the data will get better. Having said all this, the way I've always looked at Chinese data is the absolute number in itself is almost meaningless. The trend, however, is important. And so what you really want to look at is the first derivative. Is inflation accelerating or not? Is growth accelerating or not? Are profits accelerating or not? And even if the absolute numbers themselves can be questioned, the trend tends to be broadly right. And when it comes to China, what matters the most is, as Keynes used to say, is you want to be approximately right rather than precisely wrong.
Louis, sadly, we've run out of time. Hopefully, we get to finish this conversation in person when I see you in a few weeks' time in San Diego. But until then, just let the folks at home know where they can find out more about Gavco, because it is one of the best research firms out there anywhere in the world.
That's very kind, Grant. I do look forward to seeing you in San Diego at Malden's event. In the meantime, the best place, to be honest, is our website. Our website, which is gavco.com. Obviously we post all our stuff there, but that's the easiest place to get in touch with us.
Fantastic. Louis, I can't thank you enough for joining us this week, and all the very best. I hope you enjoy the skiing.
Thank you very much. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. All right. Well, Louis is definitely one of my go-to guys in China. He's always so thoughtful and has a really good perspective, having spent so much time in the region. And throwing Tianyang into the mix, his incredibly insightful information really does give you a sense that there is change afoot in China. And I guess we won't know what that means, but I have to say, my gut is that Louis is right, and we are about to enter a period of inflation. How long it lasts for and how drastically the central banks try to clamp down it is anybody's guess, but I feel they're going to have to try. Sometimes, though, these forces are stronger than even the central banks, even though we may not remember. They do occasionally get punched in the nose.
Yeah, I was really interested in this point that there's, not to put words in his mouth, but almost a bubble in using excess capacity when so much of this excess capacity comes from China. It's, you know, I'm sitting here in a WeWork trying to use real estate space for startups in the short term. And you never really think that places like this and like Airbnb and Uber exist because of China. But I love that connection and that idea that as China shifts, all these things that we're used to it as the new tech economy could shift with it.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, I don't know which way. I think it may not be quite so good for the unicorns as people think. I mean, it strikes me that that they are going to run into some headwinds with funding issues. They're going to run into some headwinds with any kind of weakness in the stock market. And we've already seen Uber SoftBank deal at a vastly reduced valuation. So it is interesting if that China mood changes, it could be another wall of worry for certainly the unicorns to climb. All right, well, we have run out of time for another week, amazingly. All that remains is, you guessed it, sing along with this at the back, the legal disclaimer. Anything you heard on this episode should not be considered as trading advice. These are our opinions and the opinions of our contributors. So do your fundamental research, chart your technicals, place your stops, and always trade responsibly. Next week, we have a feature on Bitcoin. Drum roll, please. We're going to talk to a few traders who are new to the game of trading and are happening to dip their toes in the water by trading Bitcoin and try and get some real-world stories to get a sense of what it's like to trade Bitcoin when perhaps you're not a grizzled, grey-haired market veteran like me or a closet genius like Alex. But in the meantime, between now and then, if you've got an interesting question about this week's show, we would love to hear from you. So please send us an email or leave us a voice note at podcast@realvision.com.
And if you enjoy what you heard, please subscribe on iTunes.
And don't forget to leave those reviews.
Leave a review.
Leave a review. To keep up to date with the latest interviews, research publications, and, of course, podcast episodes, you can follow us on Twitter at RealVision.
We're also on Facebook and LinkedIn. Just search for RealVision.
Yes, indeed, you will find us. You can follow me on Twitter at TTMYGH, should the mood take you.
You can follow me at AcesRose.
And you can follow me at AIFJames.
AIF James. And don't forget that email, bitcoinfansjames@realvision.com. That's it from us. We will see you back here next week. Thank you so much for listening.